Time now for the second hour of the Jimmy Sangenberger Show here on News Talk 710 KNUS. So great to be with you as always. Bottom of the hour, my conversation with Joshua Scharf from the Independence Institute. First today, I want to share an interview from Thursday's edition of my web show in partnership with the Washington Examiner, Jimmy at the Crossroads. Please do subscribe in the YouTube channel, youtube.com/Jimmy at the Crossroads, with two experts on the deal reached between Israel and the United Arab Emirates and the broader strategy that the Trump administration has been engaging in for Middle East peace. Pretty remarkable stuff. Here's my interview with those experts, Ilan Berman and Mario Loyola. In recent decades, American presidents have really tried their darndest to bring peace in the Middle East, particularly between Israelis and Palestinians, Israelis and the Arab world. We've seen some positive developments over time where, for example, the United States brokered peace between Israel and Egypt. Later, we had relations open up between Israel and Jordan, and the United States helped to facilitate that. But just last week, the United Arab Emirates and Israel normalized relations. This is considerable and historic, particularly because it's the first Arab Gulf country to normalize relations with Israel, to open the door to conversations, to actually start up trade agreements, get those dialogues going on. That's just the beginning. It looks like we could see Oman and Bahrain, Morocco, other countries start opening up their doors to Israel in a way they never had before. To talk about the historical significance of this and the Trump strategy in the Middle East to help bring this about, I am very pleased to be joined by two experts in Middle East affairs. Mario Loyola is a senior fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, and Ilan Berman is vice president at the American Foreign Policy Council, and they both join us now here on Jimmy at the Crossroads. Gentlemen, welcome to the show. It's so good to have you.
Great to be here.
I really appreciate it, especially because this is so historic in a complex region of the world. I mean, the complications that are involved here are tremendous. We also have seen past administrations look at this idea of let's bring peace in the Middle East by bringing together the Israelis and the Palestinians. We're seeing something very different go on at this point in terms of what President Trump is doing. Let's start with you, Mario, please, about some of the historical context here. You had a great piece in National Review last week that really laid out a lot of the history here and sort of how some of this has evolved over time. What's your takeaway?
Well, I think the key insight starts with understanding what makes America valuable to the governments of the Middle East. As I said in my piece, and I've written many times before, Obama was operating under a very profound misconception about why people were talking to him, why people were talking to the government of the United States in the Middle East. The reason why the United States is valuable is not because people are interested in what the American president thinks is fair or just or right. What they want from the United States is for the United States to be able to serve an underwriting role, just like underwriters in a financial transaction, in a bond flotation, or an initial public offering, where the underwriter, the United States, is underwriting the risks of security, the risks of the deal, to the person who's really putting their security at risk, which in this case is Israel. And Israel will make much greater concessions for peace with the United States standing strongly behind it than if Israel is worried about the United States. And so that's why Obama taking a more impartial role as arbiter of the dispute between Palestinians and Israelis made the United States irrelevant to both the Palestinians and the Israelis. Trump has gone in a very different direction. He's standing firmly beside Israel. He's moving against Israel's enemies, such as Iran. He's continuing with maximum pressure on Iran, pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal, ordered the killing of Qasem Soleimani, is likely doing other things on a covert level. moved the embassy to Jerusalem. All of these things have served to make the United States relevant again in the Middle East, both as a strong ally of Israel and as a relevant negotiating partner for the Arab side. And I think that that's been indispensable to bringing the Arabs and the Israelis closer together.
I want to play a clip. This is cut two. It's Jared Kushner over the weekend on the Fox News channel talking about how this all came about as the culmination of 3 years of diplomacy and sort of a different perspective, a different outlook being brought by the Trump administration to Middle East policy. And when we come back after playing the clip, Ilan Berman, I'm going to want to get your thoughts on that as well as what Mario Loyola just shared. Take a look at this.
So this deal is really the culmination of 3.5 years of incredible diplomacy by President Trump. President Trump started his administration with his first foreign trip, where he went to Riyadh, where he addressed the 54 Muslim nations. Then he went to Israel, where he met with the Jewish leaders. And then he went to Rome, where he met with the Pope and other leaders. And so President Trump has set out a course to really change the Middle East and to try to bring more peace to the world. This was a great culmination of it. And there's a lot of steps along the way. We hosted a conference in Warsaw where we brought the Middle East closer together. We hosted a conference in Bahrain where we brought everyone together. And, you know, even the president's steps that he took, which were widely criticized in the foreign policy world, like moving the embassy to Jerusalem, was a very critical step. That showed people in the region that, number one, President Trump, unlike past politicians, keeps his promises, and he won't be bullied out of doing things that he thinks is right. And that strength and courage of conviction allowed him to build very strong relationships with our regional allies that had previously been forsaken. And that confidence that they both had in him allowed them to take this historic step forward. And I'll also say that one of the other critical steps along the way was President Trump getting out of the disastrous Iran deal. That deal sent $150 billion to the largest state sponsor of terrorism, one of the worst deals perhaps in history. And President Trump's leadership has greatly constrained the reach of a big menace in the region.
Ilan Berman, Vice President at the American Foreign Policy Council, what Jared Kushner, Senior Advisor of the President, was talking about, and he's been running point on a lot of the Middle East policy, helping out there. He talked about the Warsaw and Bahrain conferences, which were significant opportunities to bring these countries together. He talked about how President Trump has kept his promises, for example, on Jerusalem, and he's been rebuilding this this idea that the United States understands the threat that Iran poses, hence withdrawing from the Iranian nuclear deal, doing things to mend fences in the region with countries that had been sort of set aside by the Obama presidency, the Obama administration. What do you make of that, and what are you seeing here from a strategic standpoint that the Trump administration is doing that has brought about such a truly unprecedented and historic feat, and how it differs from previous administrations?
Right. So I think there's really three big points that need to be made here. First of all, the new agreement between the UAE and Israel is historic, but it's not surprising. In fact, it is the culmination of a decade or more of quiet diplomacy that the Israelis have been engaging in.
Right.
With regard to not only the UAE, but a number of other countries in the Persian Gulf and in North Africa. And that dialogue initially started as shared concerns over a rising Iran, a nearly nuclear Iran, and one that seemed to be on the march in the Middle East. But over the last several years, those ties have expanded to include everything from trade to infrastructure to telecom to really all aspects of bilateral relations. And those quiet conversations are now moving out into the open. They're sort of their coming of age. And I suspect that the UAE-Israel deal is just the beginning, because there are other countries like Bahrain, like Oman, like Morocco, that are likely contenders to be next. Right. The second big point is that this is an enormous triumph for Israeli foreign policy. This is, I would argue, this is the single cardinal sort of largest achievement of Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu's foreign policy credentials. And, you know, those are pretty big credentials, because what he's managed to do over the last decade is to fundamentally reorient the conversation in the Middle East. A dozen years ago, when you looked at Israeli politics, center, left, right, every single party, if they wanted to be taken seriously, had to have some sort of plan for engagement with the Palestinians. That's not the case anymore, right? And so what you've seen over the last decade is the shift from an inside-out strategy to an outside-in strategy. The old paradigm was that you had to make peace with the Palestinians first before you could talk to the Arab world. But what we're seeing today is that's actually not true. In fact, Israel has managed to build very robust relations with an assortment of countries in the Middle East, even though the Israeli-Palestinian track is frozen, at least for now. Right? And this gets us to sort of the third point, that the deal is the culmination of the Trump administration's approach to the Middle East, but it is very much part of a larger approach. So the conventional wisdom has been for a long time that the White House doesn't know what it's doing in the Middle East, that it's sort of fumbling around, and even at times it's eyeing the exits and it wants to get out of regional entanglements. But if you look closely, what the administration's actually been pursuing has been this sort of this three-pronged policy, right? On the one hand, you have maximum pressure against Iran in the form of economic sanctions and political pressure designed to isolate Iran, bring them back to the negotiating table internationally. The second prong is the deal of the century. Mr. Kushner said, broad framework for prosperity between Israel and the Palestinians. But right in the middle, the connective tissue between those two poles is this idea of a Middle East security alliance, a security architecture in the Middle East that could function something like an Arab NATO that could provide security for Israel, but also net Israel more closely into regional politics. And so that, to me, is sort of, I think right now, the most germane aspect of the strategy, because that's what we're making progress on. Israel's getting more secure, is expanding its relations in the region. And I think things are changing in a big way.
Mario Loyola, I think that one of the things that we can pull from what Ilan was just describing is that the Trump administration came in, they saw the many flaws, failures of the Obama policy, cozying up to Iran while distancing itself from the United States, rather from the allies in the Middle East, the Arab countries, and from Israel. And they recognized also that meanwhile, you had Israel doing back channel conversations with the UAE and many other countries. And they saw that this opportunity there that I think the Obama administration just didn't care about, didn't see any reason to follow through. Speak to that a little bit, please. And then I know that you have this idea, and I think it fits right in the conversation about sort of the simple rule for Middle East policy relative to the Obama administration's policy.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to say, I don't look at, what the Trump administration saw coming in at the beginning of 2017 quite the way that you just described it. What I remember thinking every year of the Obama administration was that with every year that passed under Obama policies, we were going to have more and more of a disaster to clean up and more to fix. I think that the Bush administration handed off to the Obama administration a situation in the Middle East that had been very difficult, but that had been brought to a promising point. I mean, we had achieved victory in Iraq essentially between 2007 and 2008. All of the major political groupings in Iraq, except for the two extremist groups, were in favor of an ongoing lasting alliance with the United States. That in turn was an essential pillar of an architecture of containing Iran that rested on the rest of our regional alliances, particularly with the Gulf Arabs, putting pressure on the Iran nuclear program and support for the pro-democracy movement inside Iran. And that's what the Obama administration needed to do, was to keep strengthening that relationship with Iraq, keep strengthening our regional alliances, keep putting pressure on the Iran nuclear program, keep supporting the pro-democracy movement in Iran. And of course, what the Obama did in every case was exactly the opposite. In every one of those instances, it did exactly the opposite. And so the fundamentals began to deteriorate very rapidly. Within 3 years of Obama taking power, the United States was out of Iraq and ISIS was on the march. Of course, Obama completely misdiagnosed what a serious threat ISIS was. And then when the Obama administration finally got back into the game to move against ISIS in some small measure, they basically did it as Iran's subordinate proxy air force. And so everything that the United States was doing, because they were doing it at such a small scale within Iraqi politics, they were really just an adjutant to the Iranian program of hegemony inside of Iraq. And so with every year that passed, the situation deteriorated more and more. The Syrian civil war got going. The Obama administration decided not to intervene in the Syrian civil war. We can debate whether that was a good decision or not, but they simultaneously decided to let other people intervene in the Syrian civil war on the other side. And then they decided not to do anything about defending Iraq from the consequences of this civil war, which is what allowed the civil war to spill over to the Iraqi side. So by the time the Trump administration gets to power, what it's looking at in the Middle East is a complete disaster, with Iranian power extending all the way from Iran to Israel's borders in Lebanon, and another pincer forming through Yemen to threaten Israel from the south, essentially, now that Iran has taken the place of Arab extremist regimes in supporting the Hamas. And so it was very important to move in the other direction. And I'll just close by saying that I was in the White House already at the time on the environmental policy side, and I was I had my doubts about whether the president could be effective given how skeptical he was of America's long-term commitments in the Middle East. And I'm happy to see that as the years have passed, the Trump administration and President Trump personally have come to see that without going as far as nation building, it's important for the United States, it's important for America's position in the world, for the United States to remain the preeminent power in the Middle East. And that's what makes all of these peaceful developments possible.
We're wrapping up our conversation with Ilan Berman, who's vice president at the American Foreign Policy Council, and Mario Loyola, senior fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Ilan, your thoughts on what Mario just shared?
No, I think Mario is exactly correct. And you do have that creative tension that exists in the Trump administration's approach to the region. There is a tendency on the part of the president, on the part of his advisors, to not be very excited about open-ended commitments. And so the way the administration has backed away from engagement in northern Syria, engagement in Afghanistan, reflects a worry that, there is mission creep, that we're going to be in the region forever without defined objectives. But I would point out that is not the same thing as not having a strategy for the region. And in fact, it's very clear, as Mario said, that the administration has planted some very important flags in the region about things that it thinks are very important and necessary to do in order to preserve the security of our allies and preserve American interests, right? That conversation starts at maximum pressure vis-a-vis Iran, right? Because the administration, from its earliest days, identified the 2015 nuclear deal with Iran as a vehicle for Iranian empowerment rather than a vehicle for Iranian moderation, right? The big gamble that the Obama administration bet on was the idea that if we were nicer to Iran, if we provided them with massive direct and indirect sanctions relief, they would behave better regionally. And what that ended up doing was empowering Iran's worst impulses. And the Trump administration has been trying to put Iran back into a box for its entire term so far. And it's been successful in doing that. Maximum pressure has had a lot of impact on the stability of the regime, Iranian solvency. But that's not the sum total of what the administration is trying to do in the Middle East. There's a lot of things going on, and I think we ignore them. When we ignore them, we don't really understand sort of what the real lay of the land in the region is.
Mario Loyola, real quick, where do you think things will head next? Because I think there's reason for optimism that I know you write in your piece that it's possible Saudi Arabia could finally open up relations with Israel. Oman and Bahrain are being talked about, and Morocco. Where do you see things going?
So the countries that you just mentioned, Bahrain, Oman, Saudi Arabia, these are the Gulf Cooperation Council, which are the sort of military partners of the United States among the Gulf kingdoms, and they coordinate their foreign policy very, very closely. So I think it's fair to expect it's reasonable to expect that they will follow in UAE's footsteps. The United Arab Emirates has always had the most pro-Anglo orientation of all of these kingdoms, so it's not surprising that they moved first. But I would also point out we have the President Trump receiving the Prime Minister of Iraq this week, and that's another very important move, and I hope that people don't forget that Iraq really matters. Iraq is a very valuable potential ally for the United States. It has remained a partner of the United States even during the time when the Obama administration sort of didn't really care about Iraq and was happy to let the Iranians take over Iraq. Well, it turns out that the Iraqis were not happy to let the Iranians take over Iraq, even though half their country is Shiite. And that's a very, very hopeful sign, because if America is able to revive Iraq as its alliance with Iraq as a strong one in the region, Iraq could eventually become America's most important ally in the Middle East. And if that happens, then the containment of Iran will really have moved forward by leaps and bounds. And that's the kind of containment that will set the Islamic Revolution of Iran onto its final days. So I hope that America remains committed to that alliance with Iraq.
A quick add-on, Ilan, anything you want to add real quick?
No, I think Mario's right. I mean, the real fundamental question, especially germane now because we're in the political season, is what the president wants to do vis-a-vis Iran moving forward, and what his Democratic challenger wants to do. I mean, there's a very contrasting visions for the region. I would make the argument that the different approaches have been tried before, right? Both of them. And it's very clear which one has garnered the United States more success and American allies more security.
No doubt. I think that's a great final note, although I will add this, that it wasn't that long ago, just a handful of months ago, I had my first of two interviews on this program with Fahad Nazir, the official spokesperson for the Saudi embassy in D.C. And I asked him a question. I said, so it seems like Israel and Saudi Arabia have some thawing relations. And his response was, we have no relations with Israel. So it was an interesting response at the time, not surprising at all. I figured I would get something along those lines, but maybe sometime in the near future, we will hear a different response from the Saudi embassy. Ilan Berman with the American Foreign Policy Council and Mario Loyola at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Thank you so much. We could go for so much longer at this conversation, but I really appreciate your insights today.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
All right, we're going to take a quick break here on the Jimmy Sangenberger Show, News Talk 710 KNUS. When we come back, my interview with Joshua Scharf, talking about what California is doing to essentially push Uber and Lyft out of business in their state, and what our own Jason Crow of the 6th Congressional District would like to see happen nationally. You do not want to miss this. Stay tuned. It's the Jimmy Sangenberger Show.
I'm a man of a many words. I can speak thanks to you, darling, my dear. I can swear that you never heard. I rap strong and I know I rap long. Come on, mama, let me turn you on. Now, come on. All right. When I rap my game and call your name, you would never be the same. And the midnight hours when you dream, my darling, I swear you will call my name. I rap strong and I know I rap long. Come on, mama, let me turn you on. Come on.
Welcome back to the Jimmy Sangenberger Show, News Talk 710 KNUS. Good to be with you. And I have to say that, yes, I am a man of many words. That's one motivation for playing this tune, but I love that style, Buddy Guy, along with Junior Wells playing the blues, although I don't think Junior Wells is in that song. I don't hear any harmonica or hearing him singing in the tune, but it is from an album that was released either in the late 60s or early 70s. I can't remember, but Buddy Guy and Junior Wells Play the Blues. Definitely worth checking it out. Once again, you're listening to the Jimmy Sangenberger Show here on News Talk 710 KNUS. And it is during the week that I am talking with our next guest here on the Jimmy Sangenberger Show, because otherwise he wouldn't be available, because Saturday is Shabbat. Shabbat Shalom to Joshua Scharf joining us here on the Jimmy Sangenberger Show on News Talk 710 KNUS, Fiscal Policy Fellow at the Independence Institute, senior fellow. What's up, Joshua? Shabbat Shalom.
Yes, my weekday self will accept your sabbatical salutations on behalf of my Saturday self. Thank you very much. I'm glad you're able to take this with me during the week.
Oh, absolutely. Well, Joshua, I so appreciate the time, and there are several things I want to jump into with you. We'll talk in a few minutes about what's going on in California in terms of this new law that will devastate, if it moves forward, devastate California's gig economy, including Uber and Lyft. I mean, they're ready to hightail it out of California. Jason Crow, congressman from the 6th Congressional District, supports federal legislation to do the same thing. We'll talk about that with you tonight. In a few minutes, we'll also discuss the subject of the Middle East peace agreement between Israel and the United Arab Emirates, which we talked about, or I shared in the previous segment with two guests on that very topic. But Joshua, I want to first ask you about the Independence Institute. I know that last weekend it was ransacked, and I'm curious what you can tell us happened down at the Freedom Embassy.
Yeah, so obviously we call it the Freedom Embassy because it's not just Independence, which uses the downstairs facilities, the meeting facilities there are available to a wide variety of conservative and liberty-oriented groups. And so over the weekend, one of them was having a meeting there, and so somebody figured out that this would be a good target for, you know, the Antifa types, the anti-freedom types. And so sneaked in, I guess, you know, everybody, when you're attending a meeting like that and you don't know everyone else who's there, or you're not paying particularly close attention, you assume that everybody who walks in is supposed to be there. And so that's what he did. And then he hid for about 6 hours. He hid.
Wow.
While the meeting was going on. Right. And then he found a place where he could hide. And when everyone left, he got out and he committed a certain amount of destruction. There's a downstairs studio down there. There were some cameras that were stolen. There was some damage done there. Books were strewn around. There was it appeared that he got into the studio by, it appears this way. I was not there, fortunately, so I didn't see it, but it appears as though he got into the studio by smashing a window and then opening the handle from the inside.
Wow.
It really, yeah, there was damage done there. And so, it really, and it does not appear that this was just some, you know, random homeless guy.
No.
It appears that this was somebody who knew what they were doing, picked out Independence as a target. You know, we're right across the street from a police substation, a police precinct station, I should say. And so, it's possible that during one of the various, you know, protests and marches that target the police, somebody looked over right. And said, "Hey, there's a statue of Jefferson over there. What are these people up to?" You know, and so,
well, I mean,
there we go.
It has to be somebody with malintent towards freedom loving liberty movement types like we are, because they wouldn't wait 6 hours in hiding before they ransacked the place. They really wanted
no,
to.
I mean,
they had a motivation.
No, there was some discipline there. And it, like I say, on the camera, on the video, it doesn't look like this is just a homeless guy who just decided, you know, hey, I can commit to, you know, I can do something. And I'm not meaning to slander, you know, homeless people here. I'm just suggesting that it does not appear that it was a random attack. It
right.
appears that it was a premeditated and somewhat well thought out
well,
assault on really the premier institution that fights against this sort of thing.
Yeah. Well, and I will add, too, that this is particularly the result of these extremists feeling emboldened because the police, the authorities, simply will not act. They're not permitted to act in a way that is conducive to preventing these types of things from happening. And so they are emboldened, they are increasingly brazen, and they will carry out these kinds of attacks on innocent people and buildings and property and individuals. So it really is just tragic what's going on in our state of Colorado. Joshua Scharf, senior fellow at the Independence Institute, focusing on fiscal policy. Joshua, I want to jump into, and by the way, just from myself, I'm sure everybody at 710KNUS may have been talked about earlier in the week, but we all appreciate what Independence Institute does, providing a great opportunity for the conservative movement in this state of Colorado to meet, to gather, and you did so much work at Independence Institute in addition to allowing, or maybe the allowing part is folks to use the facilities, is in addition to all the work that the Independence Institute is doing. But it really is tremendous. So our thoughts, prayers, appreciation to everybody in Independence Institute, Joshua, and I hope you all stay safe.
Thank you. Yeah, fortunately, no one was there at the time. No one got injured. Mm-hmm. And there was no, you know, physical confrontation with this guy.
Yeah.
But the property damage itself is bad enough. You know, now we have the big alcohol, tobacco, and firearms, not in that order, fundraiser coming up, and you know, some of the money that we're able to raise through that is going to have to be devoted to repairing this damage rather than actively promoting the cause of liberty.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Joshua Scharf, let's shift gears. I do want to talk about the fiscal stuff and what's happening in California, how it could come nationally. But I know that you are very attuned to foreign policy matters, particularly in the Middle East. You are naturally a strong supporter of Israel. And so I would be remiss if I didn't take a moment to get your thoughts on what I shared in the last segment about this peace deal that was reached between Israel and the United Arab Emirates, the UAE being the very first Arab Gulf state to make normalize relations with Israel, which is pretty remarkable. The Trump administration really has been working hard at this, trying to get the Middle East to go a different direction, using a different strategy than before. And I think it's pretty remarkable. Well, what are your thoughts on what's happening?
Yeah, well, you know, thanks, Obama. You finally earned your peace prize by making Iran a big enough threat to force the Arab countries to recognize that it's better to have peace with Israel than to, you know, than that they can use Israel as an ally. But I speak somewhat sarcastically there, but that's really a large part of the dynamic that's at play here. What's happened is that over time, many of the Gulf states who have not been, with the exception of Qatar, and of course, historically, Saudi Arabia, have been drawing closer to Israel over time. And many of the Gulf states themselves were never really, you know, sort of ideologically hateful. They were sort of more geopolitically hateful, and so, or strategically hateful, I guess. And so what's happened now is that, you know, the UAE is right, is like 15 miles across the water from Iran. Oman and Bahrain. Bahrain has a majority Shiite population. And so they don't want, they're always nervous that the Iranians are going to be stirring up trouble there. And so Oman is in a similar situation, not necessarily in terms of the internal population, but just not really being ideologically opposed to Israel. And so they've decided that it's in their best interest to go ahead and formally normalize relations, which had been sort of bubbling along, sort of under the surface, informally and unofficially, but now to be able to openly conduct trade, be able to openly conduct diplomatic relations, be able to openly cooperate militarily, and that will open up a whole new world of cooperation with them. There also is rumors that Morocco may be considering this, and that Sudan, which has recently elected a president who's actually committed to human rights and stuff.
Wow.
I mean, the guy, yeah, the Sudan appears to have a good guy as president, and he's making noises, or their government is making noises. Although today they denied that there was any official move underway, but they're also being, they were the ones who floated this. So,
well, you know, a lot of these agreements are being reached sort of under wraps anyway, because until they're ready to formally announce something, they don't really want anybody to get an indication of that. For example, it's why Bibi Netanyahu was saying on Fox News this past last weekend that a lot of these things are happening behind the scenes, and they're waiting to the right time to actually make it official or make any sort of announcement.
No, it makes perfect sense. And yeah. And I think that's almost certainly correct. I think who would have thought, in our lifetimes that you would have had some of these countries embracing Israel as a legitimate international entity. And really it puts a lot of pressure on the Palestinians.
Sure.
To be more reasonable. One hopes that they take that opportunity.
That's part of the strategy here. Outside in instead of inside out. The idea, let's bring all the Arab countries together and that with Israel, and then that will put pressure on the Palestinians. It's going to take time. It's not a panacea, not quick. We'll see what happens moving forward, but there is reason for some optimism. Joshua Scharf is our guest, who is Fiscal Policy Fellow, Senior Fellow at the Independence Institute. It's time now for a bonus bumper that will lead us into our economic discussion for the next several minutes. Folks, it's time to make some easy money. Folks, this is one of those songs that when you have a man fill in for you on your old morning show, Business for Breakfast, and he recommends it as one of the bumpers when he's filling in on a feel-good Friday, you take note of it because it's so damn good. Billy Joel, that easy buddy, here on the Jimmy Sangenberger Show, News Talk 7, 10 KNUS. You digging this little bonus bumper, Joshua Scharf, my friend?
I love me some Billy Joel. I gotta tell you, one of the things that makes him special, just very briefly, because
sure,
we don't have
please,
unlimited
please.
Time. One of the things that makes him special, he's one of the few stars who not only reads music, but really knows how to compose. A lot of the people you hear singing, Taylor Swift, for instance, don't read music. They played the melody, they learned the melody, they, you know, sort of follow the key that it's supposed to be in, but they don't really read music. This guy, I mean, he's trained. Lady Gaga is another one. And so as a result, because they can write, they can read, and they can compose, their music doesn't just sound like everyone else's. And I just, Billy Joel, his stuff going all the way back to Glass Houses. Mm. I just sit there and listen to one album after another. He's terrific.
Well, and I figured, you know, people are looking for ways to make some easy money. But sometimes if the government gets in the way, you can't make any money because they say Uber, Lyft, you have to reclassify your workers. Well, the people who are working for you as contractors, you need to reclassify them as employees because we, the all-knowing, all-powerful government, deem that to be appropriate and necessary so they can get all the benefits, so on and so forth. But alas, when that happens, a company like Uber and Lyft has to announce, hey, we just might have to hightail it on out of California because we cannot afford to make this switch that the state of California is requiring us. So this week, and that's exactly what happened, folks, by the way. I'm not just painting a scenario. California actually passed such a law. And Uber and Lyft on Thursday night at midnight were going to say, hey, I'm out. We're out because we cannot afford it. A court came in and intervened and gave them 10 days to go file appeals. But Joshua Scharf, this is a pretty dramatic type of step that is absolutely eviscerating the gig economy in California, or will if it is allowed to continue moving forward.
Last year, the state assembly passed something called AB 5. So that would be Assembly Bill 5. And what it did was it set a test for what is considered an independent contractor and what's considered a regular employee. What they did was they set the test narrowly enough that if you're performing regular work, and it's sort of the usual business that the company is involved in, and it's and if you are not necessarily doing that work elsewhere, and if you're supervised, and so this is a meaning that this sort of meets performance requirements that a regular employee would, then you are considered a regular employee. What that means is you have to meet minimum wage. You have to meet benefit standards. You have to have a certain amount of hours per week that you have to be. So what this does is this makes hiring contractors who are sort of in the normal course of business, something like that Uber and Lyft do, it makes it all but impossible to do that. It makes it far too expensive. And so it forces them, what they did when this took effect, they said, you know, this, we're going to have to reexamine our relationship here in California. And so this week they said, you know, sayonara, we're out of here because we just can't do business here. We can't we can't treat people who are independent contractors who we've not had to pay benefits for instance, as independent contractors. By the way, nobody's forcing anyone to take these jobs. Nobody's forcing somebody to drive for Uber or Lyft. Nobody's forcing them to operate that way. So these are often first step jobs. You see a lot of immigrants who will take them as their free, you know, if they get their driver's license, they get their car, they're able to drive for these companies, and they can bring in some money. And it's kind of a first rung kind of a job. And in the grand tradition of progressives everywhere, they're you know, perfectly happy to cut out that first rung from people who are trying to climb up the economic ladder.
Yeah, it's just so terrible. But by the way, if this were to happen and then Uber and Lyft were to hightail it out of California, then what do you do in terms of trying to win over millennials and Generation Z, Joshua Scharf, is you say it's the Democrats, it's the liberals who are taking away your ride-sharing opportunities, maybe your ride-sharing jobs or your ability to get from place A to place B in Uber or Lyft. Now you got to go back to taxi cabs, kids.
Well, and of course, the cab companies keep very tight supply control. So it's not even a matter of you have to go back to taxi cabs. You know,
right.
It's if you have to go back to taxi cabs, if you can, if
find
you can
one.
Afford the medallion.
Yes.
You know, if you can find an opening. And so this actually had a there were some exceptions that were written into the law, but there was a concern that it really would have an effect on trucking there, because you have independent owner operators, especially people who maybe pick up loads from the ports and take them to the railheads or take them from the ports to their final destination, and those drivers are almost all in, or I shouldn't say almost all, in many cases are independent contractors or small companies who are then hired out by other larger companies. This would have had an effect on that. I think there was some litigation that kept that from taking full effect. But this was done primarily as a sop to the unions. Not only does it make it more difficult to compete with unionized work, it also makes it more likely that the unions would be able to come and say, well, you want to work in this business, you have to join the union, and then we'll represent you. And then, you know, maybe you can continue doing the kind of work that you want to do. So, you know, consider the implications of those words. The concern. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to shift over to the federal level possibility. But if you have more to say, please go ahead.
No, that's where I was going.
Okay. So let me lead us into that direction. The concern is that we could see this happen at the federal level, because a guy like Jason Crow, representing my congressional district, of the 6th Congressional District, would like to see a federal variation of this law. And what happens then? Well, Uber and Lyft can't just leave one state. Then they're in a problem, a conundrum with how do you deal about all 50 states. But what is Jason Crow and some of his cohorts, what are they looking at here?
Yeah, this was House resolution. So at the federal level, here in Colorado, if you're passing it, if you have a bill that comes to the House called HB, House Bill, at the federal level, it's House resolution. So HR 2474 of the current Congress would have, in effect, it would have duplicated the three-prong test that I just laid out. It would have duplicated that test for all business, for businesses nationwide. And would have, in effect, you know, driven those companies out of business, but it would have made gig work in general, including, you know, by the way, software work, including any number of all sorts of occupations that have become where it's increasingly popular to take, you know, sort of short-term gig work or even long-term gig work rather than becoming a formal employee of the company. It would essentially have outlawed that. What's particularly irritating, or should be irritating, to residents of Jason Crow's district. He's one of the co-sponsors. He's not an original sponsor. He's one of the co-sponsors of it.
Gotcha.
And he did vote for it when it came up for a vote earlier this year. His district includes the tech center. You know, it includes an area where a lot of these kinds of workers live and or work. And so, you know, it would have made life very difficult on a lot of those workers. They should bear that in mind when they are going to the polls in November, exactly what he has in for them for their careers.
Yeah, no doubt about it. And like I said before, this is the kind of winning issue I think conservatives can be talking about with young people who like their ride sharing and their Postmates and DoorDash and everything. And now, especially in this climate with COVID-19 and so forth, you don't want to have these kinds of restrictions that shut down these businesses really quick, Joshua.
No, that's exactly right. And it's all sorts of stuff like that. There are people who have all kinds of independent businesses where they just take a contract to do something. And this makes it much harder for people. It also just makes it hard, not even with COVID, just in general. It makes it harder for people who want to switch careers, for people who want to get started in something, or for people who are just trying to climb up the economic ladder. It chops that out. It's a terrible, terrible idea.
So true. Joshua Scharf, senior fellow at the Independence Institute, joining us during the week so he can, of course, do what he needs to do for Shabbat. Thank you so much, my friend. Shabbat Shalom.
Take care. Thanks a lot, Jimmy.
Once again, Joshua Scharf joining us on the Jimmy Sangenberger Show. We're going to take a break. We'll be back with a third and final hour. Don't go anywhere.